Good day and welcome to Letters in Politics. I'm Mitch Jezerich. 8 states across the United States today are holding primary elections before heading into the November midterm, including here in California, which will be a main battleground for Democrats' attempt to win the leadership of the House of Representatives. California is a state where we are broadcasting from, and it's quite remarkable to see the interest in a primary for a midterm election that are usually unnoticed except by the diehards. I was specifically struck while walking home the other night through downtown Oakland and seeing the streets literally littered with campaign flyers on all type of issues. Today, democracies are ubiquitous. Even countries that have authoritarian dictators call themselves democracies in name. But in history, democracy is definitely the anomaly and not the norm. The first fully formed democratic system that we have records for, meaning a lot of records about yet still incomplete, is from 2,500 years ago in Athens, Greece. There, democracy lasted for about 200 years and then was extinguished and not seen again for at least another 1,000 years, perhaps longer. This actually gets us into an argument of what democracy precisely is, and is it something that is inherent in people that have been practiced by people over the world for a very long time, even longer than 2,500 years? And that's a good conversation to have. We'll have that conversation another time, because today we are going to focus on Athenian democracy, and you can at least make a claim that the type of democracy we have today, albeit quite different than the direct democracy that you had in Athens 2,500 years ago, is still a link to that type of democracy. So today, again, we are going to talk about this very issue, democracy in Athens, its rise, its fall, how it worked, and why it all matters. My guest is renowned Greek scholar Paul Cartledge of Cambridge University. He is the author of the book Democracy, A Life. Paul Cartledge, it is my very good pleasure to welcome you to this program.
It's entirely my pleasure, Mitch. Thanks for having me on KPFA.
Well, I'm excited to do it. I love having these type of conversations. And so I said Athenian democracy, 200 years or so. And when we say Athenian democracy, and I think you point this out in your book, Democracy of Life, what Athenian democracy are we talking about? There's different iterations of it during different periods of time. I guess I'm thinking more around 508, 507 BC to, I don't know, right around 330s BC. Does that sound about right to you? How do you see it, the parameters?
It does sound exactly right. The word demokratia, of course, a Greek word, combines two ancient Greek words, demos, people, or the masses of the people, and kratos, meaning power. That word was coined somewhere in the 5th century BC, probably somewhere around 470 or so. So in other words, a few decades after the thing, a version of people power was introduced, as you say, round about 500 BC or BCE.
And in Athens, which we call Athens today, did they call it democracy, their form of government?
They did indeed. They were very proud of it because it was indeed an Athenian invention. But we have to remember that Athens then was not the capital of a big state such as Greece today, but it was itself a state. It was its own political entity. But it was one of about 1,000 Greek political entities scattered all around the Mediterranean, around the Black Sea. So Hellas, the ancient Greek world, a much more complicated, variegated political grouping than anything that we might think of as a unitary state today. So Athens, partly by its differentiation of itself from other Greek cities, partly actually through conflict with one particular other Greek state, that's Sparta, self-identified as particularly, peculiarly entrusting the adult male citizen population. Remember, no women, of course, were empowered, and they had slaves. This is not a modern liberal democracy.
Where did the slaves come from in ancient Greece?
Slaves came from all round the periphery of the Aegean. They typically preferred, this is, I suppose, a normal thing, to enslave outsiders, non-Greeks, And Greeks were very keen on the notion that the world was divided into two kinds of people. You're either a Greek or you're not a Greek. And if you're not, you're a barbarian. And you're a barbarian because your language is unintelligible. Bah, bah, bah. You're therefore inferior because you don't speak an intelligible language. And, well, this is a really sad thing to have to tell you, but Aristotle, who in many ways was one of the greatest thinkers of ancient Greece, amazing in biology and philosophy and so on, nevertheless, he tried to justify the fact that the Greeks saw the world this way and thought it was okay to enslave, that is, to deprive of freedom other human beings. So the Greeks enslaved people through the slave trade, typically. And they came from what's today Turkey, what's today Bulgaria, what's today Sicily. There are lots of places around the Mediterranean world from which Greeks derived their unfree people.
Was there ever a debate? Have we ever seen any kind of evidence for a debate about slavery in the ancient world?
That's a very, very good question. Aristotle, in his attempted justification of slavery, which comes in the Politics, which means a work about the Greek political form called the polis, the city-state or citizen-state. He says some people, and he means some free thinkers, some really, if you like, liberal, enlightened thinkers, believe that all servitude, that is, whoever's enslaving whom, is wrong ethically because it's based on force. And that human beings should relate to each other purely on the basis of free exchange, interchange, on a basis ideally of equality. Well, they, of course, were way off the spectrum. I mean, really, if we like, left wing. But he tries to rebut them by saying, no, no, some people, by nature, that is unalterably, have something missing from their psyche, such that they are irrational or non-rational, and therefore they need to be enslaved so that they can function properly, and therefore they need to be enslaved by somebody who is by nature not a slave, and that means therefore by a Greek. I mean, it's to me a ghastly set of arguments. It's not really a very good argument, but the point is that for Aristotle, what slaves do is enable non-slaves, slave owners and people who are not themselves slaves, to do politics, which he thought was the highest form of social intercourse.
And we would learn much, and we get one of our main, I guess, sources of ancient Athenian democracy comes from Aristotle's Politics.
It does, because he and his pupils at his school, he set up an institute in Athens. It's sort of like the Princeton Institute for Advanced Study back in the 330s BC. He sent his pupils around many of the Greek cities, about 150 of them, and asked people, you know, how does your political system work? They brought their data back. Aristotle crunched them, and then he brought out the Politics, which is a summation of how Greeks do politics, where they go wrong, how it can be done better. And to us, it's odd that he was not himself a democrat, and he thought that he wasn't a democrat because he didn't think that ordinary people were as smart as elite intellectuals like him, and that he thought that people who were not well-educated, perhaps not that bright, should not have an equal say, let alone a majority say, in a democratic system. So he intellectually was not a democrat, though he wasn't a rabid anti-democrat as his former teacher was, Plato, who really took a very strong anti-democratic line.
I almost feel like we're getting to the end here, so we'll just have to skip around time a little bit. But in line with that, one of the main reasons Plato was such an anti-democrat was because what happened to his teacher, Socrates.
That's quite right. Socrates was an Athenian and not a terribly well-off one, but not a terribly poor one. But he hobnobbed with rich young people who were typically not very democratic. In fact, sometimes one or two of them were actually anti-democrats, and one or two of them were actually traitors. So when things didn't go well for the Athenians, they lost a major war. They looked for a scapegoat, and they were particularly concerned about the wrath of the gods, and possibly people like Socrates, who even questioned the nature of deity, divinity. What were the gods like? How should one worship? Perhaps the gods had got angry, and it's because of Socrates that they had lost this great war and then suffered an occupation by Sparta and then an imposition of a very nasty junta, a regime of extreme oligarchs. So I think he partly suffered because of circumstances, and then Plato being his major pupil, we then get the torrent of abuse of the sort of democracy Athens had, because he thought it was monstrous that his teacher had been compelled to administer this hemlock, the lethal dose of poison, to himself.
And there's a term they had for it. Am I saying it correctly? Ochlocracy?
Yes, well, that's a much later coinage, as it happens, but nevertheless it captures the common view, which is one that actually goes right through from antiquity, from Plato through your founding fathers, down to people today who think it's wrong that ordinary people should have a say over matters that they really don't know enough about. So ochlocracy means literally rule or power of the mob, as opposed to the many, which is how a democrat would put it, because they would see the majority as being a good thing, whereas anti-democrats think that majority rule by itself is not necessarily good, and quite often is positively bad because it makes silly decisions.
And would even lead to the rise of a tyrant who would bring order back, and
well,
people would accept a tyrant.
Well, this is a platonic syllogism. It's, I think, pseudoscience. In other words, it is the case that in certain political systems, Greek politics being very open, very transparent, and leading quite often actually to outright civil war. Yes, in some cases, the imposition of a single strong man had been the only way in which order could be restored, but that wasn't actually the case at Athens, even though Plato tried to tar Athens with the brush of being really very dangerous. In other words, it was dangerous particularly to people like him.
Paul Cartledge, in your book, Democracy, A Life, you say maybe one way to understand Athenian democracy would be to think of a term coined by Karl Marx, the dictatorship of the proletariat.
Yes, I put it that way deliberately in that chronicity. Marx himself was a classicist. He did his doctorate on Democritus and Epicurus, two Greek philosophers. And he was always very influenced by what he read in the ancient Greek historians. So I used Marx because he has this phrase, which is picked up by Lenin, and of course which then becomes part of 20th century parlance, which means when the masses, in order to restrain the influence, the power of the old order, the people who had held the power, particularly property power, for a very long time, they need to temporarily seize the reins of power and act as a collective dictator. Both dictator and proletariat are actually Latin-based words, but the point is, if you're not a democrat, if you are a member of the elite in the ancient world, you tend to see the masses as, in a way, simply because there are more of them. If they've all got one vote, and you've got one vote, and no one has more than one vote, the masses tend to gang up on you. And if you're an elite and you're wealthy and you're smart, you think of democracy as a very negative thing. But if you're a democrat, on the other hand, it's quite nice to have that control. The question is what you do with it. Do you use it merely negatively to, as it were, keep down the elites? Or do you use it for the good of the whole community? And that was a constant issue. Aristotle was at the center of that one.
Let's talk about the beginning of democracy, and oftentimes it's pinpointed at about 508, 507 B.C.
Yeah.
With the reforms of a reformer by the name of Cleisthenes. Before we get, we're obviously going to get into Cleisthenes. Before we do that, though, what is the situation that this comes out of? What predates a democratic system, and what does it replace?
Well, one has to go back very briefly to the very beginning with the notion of politics. That's to say, a system, a situation in which there is an organized political entity, there are rules, there are power holders, there are ways in which one legally can hold office and illegally behave in office, that thing. So there's a lawful context of politics that had been established in Athens within the past couple of hundred years, before 500, so between 700 and 500, with one major exception. In the middle of the 6th century BC, that's say about 550, a tyrant, a sole ruler, an autocrat, non-responsible, based on physical military power with a bodyguard, seized sole control and actually ruled, he and his son, for something like 35 years. Well, at that point, the Athenians had grown sufficiently self-confident that they didn't feel they any longer needed such a sole rule to, as it were, keep them in order. They wanted to do it themselves, to be, if you like, a republic. Contemporaneously with that, there was a bit of a struggle going on with Sparta. And Sparta was a state which at home was a funny kind of partly democratic, partly oligarchic, a military society. But it tried to intervene in Athenian politics on behalf of a pro-Spartan who would become, were he to be installed, a tyrant in the Spartan interest. That united just about every Athenian. They ejected the Spartan, they ejected this pro-Spartan Athenian politician, and it's in that revolutionary situation that Cleisthenes and his friends put forward their solution, which, though it wasn't called democracy, it was called something like equality under the laws. But the point was equality. So more and more Athenians should have an equal say in determining what the state's policy should be, what the state's constitution should be. He put forward his package, which was appropriate, which was accepted, and which was implemented. And that was the basis of Athenian politics for the forthcoming 3 to 4 decades, really, until a major Persian invasion of Greece. And it was because the democracy stood up to that and actually emerged even stronger than it had been beforehand that that gave terrific fillip to democracy at Athens, which then progressed and, in fact, evolved into a stronger form over the next decades.
Cleisthenes has been called the father of democracy. Do you think that's appropriate term?
I think it is because he, though we don't know much about him personally, and of course the actual text, the actual words that he himself put forward don't survive, our earliest historian, in fact he's the earliest Western historian period, namely Herodotus, who wasn't an Athenian but knew Athens well, he it is who says that Cleisthenes introduced the democracy for the Athenians. So in that sense, there is some external validation. It's not purely a propaganda claim. He really did do something which, in retrospect, could be looked back on as something like what your founding fathers did in the 1770s.
And what did he do? What's Cleisthenes?
Well, it's a very complicated thing to.
He rearranged the entire system, right?
Yeah, I could summarize it in this sense, that the assembly should now become the assembly of all citizens who were duly qualified and who could turn up, should have the final say. But in order for that to be possible, in other words, for the assembly's debates and discussions and votes to be informed, there had to be a permanent council. And that council of 500 people, which represented numerically all the different geographical and other ways in which the territory of Athens was divided up, it was a representative body. They were chosen by lot, by the random method of picking names out of a hat, as it were, based on the very, very smallest unit of all, which was called a deme, a village or a parish or a ward, in which citizens were registered at the age of 18. On the basis of the demes, each deme had to send so many councillors every year to the central body in Athens. That standing council was the filter of all the issues, and also the executive. It carried out the wishes of and administer the wishes of the assembly.
This is an important part about serving in the assembly by lot. They didn't have elections for these positions. I guess it would be compared to what we have here in the United States is when somebody gets called for jury duty.
Well, there's a combination. I should say that there were a couple of types of offices. The Athenians were not such radical democrats, not such ideologues that they threw practicality out of the window. The top offices of generals, being a commander of a large army or manager of a large amount of public funds, finances, those two types of public officials were always elected. But as a compensation, granted therefore that only a few elites would be eligible and likely to be elected, they were subject to very stringent control by the council, by the assembly, by the law courts. The lottery comes in two ways. Minor officials, less important ones, for example, ones responsible for keeping the streets clean, they were chosen by lot. All jurymen were chosen by lot, and there is a sort of echo, a pre-echo of what, as you say, you do, and we in this country likewise do. But the principle of the lot was the important one. It's egalitarian, it's random, it encourages people to put their names forward, it's not selectively privileging a notable, wealthy, aristocratic elite.
Did they vote on everything?
Yes, absolutely nothing. They had a rank order of what were the most important things, so public security, relations with the gods, they're very religious, and thirdly, finances. So those things were all, taxation, that sort of thing. These were always on every meeting of the assembly, which met once a month, and then later on it actually met every 10 days. I mean, it's quite extraordinary how often. So it's government by mass meeting in a very direct sense. Out in the open air, on the hill, just underneath the Acropolis in Athens, a hill called the Pnyx. And anybody who was entitled, that is, was registered properly as a citizen and was able physically, had the time, had the leisure, could pitch up.
We are in conversation with Paul Cartledge. Paul Cartledge is the A.G. Leventis Senior Research Fellow at Clare College and also the A.G. Leventis Professor of Greek Culture Emeritus at the University of Cambridge. We are talking about Athenian democracy from the ancient world, and he is the author of a number of books, including Democracy, A Life. They also voted on issues of war and peace. And my sense is the people of Athens were quite belligerent when it came to war.
That's a very correct perception. On average, they were at war for 2 years in every three over the 5th and 4th centuries BC, sort of a period of 150 to a couple of hundred years. So by our standards, that sounds very warlike. And it's partly because there were lots of different states with different interests and different alliance groupings, which almost inevitably clashed. There were also external powers, especially the Persian Empire to the east, which threatened the independence and the unity of the Greek world. So there are lots of reasons why you might want to be militarily prepared and why you might actually have to fight. But there was another factor, and this is, if you like, psychological and ethical. The true virtue of a man, how one showed that one really was a proper masculine person and a citizen, was indeed through warfare. The Greek word for virility or manliness was the same word as courage, as displayed in battle. So there is a one-to-one relationship between being a Greek citizen and being a warrior.
Looking at the 200-year or so life of Athenian democracy, it's probably a little less than 200 years, but we'll just put that number out there. Is there a tension that is always present in this system, and a tension that maybe at times pushes the evolution of Athenian democracy, because it would change multiple times throughout that time period. And was it at all related to just this notion, and I get the sense we see this throughout all of history, of the tension between those who are enfranchised to be involved in decision-making and participation and those who are not?
Well, there were two types of tension. One was structural, that's to say, within the citizen body. Aristotle's particularly good on this, and this is not just Athens, it's any really Greek citizen body. There tends to be quite a sharp polar opposition between those whom the Greeks call the rich. That is, they're so rich that they don't have to work for a living. They command the labor of others. They own slaves and all that. And the poor, of course, some were less poor than others, but the poor typically have to work. They don't necessarily own slaves. They don't own a lot of property. And there was a constant tension between those two. But there's another kind which you're hinting at, I think, which is between the active and the less active, shall we say, citizens. And there's a famous speech of Pericles. We're only given a version of it, and it's by the famous historian Thucydides. And one of the things Pericles is made to say in this funeral oration of 430 BC, at the end of the first season of fighting in this great world war between Athens and its allies and Sparta and its allies, is that we in Athens think that people who don't participate, who don't put forward their names for an allotted office or stand for office or serve in the army and do all the other things that a good Athenian citizen should do, we consider them useless. It's a rather powerful way of putting it.
Isn't that where the word idiot comes from?
Yes, well, our word idiot, it's rather unfair because the original Greek word meant a lay person, so someone who's not an expert, or it might be you and I, we're citizens, but we're not holding any public office, so we're private citizens as opposed to public office holders. And from that, and you're quite right, it's this ideology of participation. If you don't participate, then you are a bad citizen, but you're also dangerously, potentially, actually a drain. And it's idiotic. If you think about it, it's stupid not to want the good of the community, which will benefit you secondarily as an individual. Greeks tended to privilege the good of the common as opposed to the good of the individual. They didn't actually have a word for individual. So somebody who cuts himself off from the common life of the community is behaving idiotically.
The war with Persia, the Persian Empire, this is the big power at the time.
Yes.
But the wars with Persia, and you know, if anybody here in the United States, we have the History Channel. If you watch it enough, you'll see enough documentaries on the great battles that occurred against Persia and how Athens, and not just Athens, but I guess many together, the Greek states or the Greek city-states pulling together to combat Persia, including Sparta. But an important aspect of this is the development of a new kind of warship, and this is thanks to a great statesperson, a general, Themistocles. And with this new warship, it requires and it outmaneuvers Persia's warships, but it takes a lot more people to row these ships. And now and these are coming from the poorer classes in Athens, and you're absolutely dependent on them to operate these ships to win this war. And through that, you get greater greater enfranchisement through this, for the poor in Athens?
I think you've put it extremely well. The type of ship known as a trireme, because it's three banked, and had about 170 oarsmen and then something like 20 odd supernumerary crew, including some fighters, as well as a helmsman and a captain. This type of ship actually was not a Greek invention. It had been invented by probably the Phoenicians. It had been developed, that is, Phoenicians of what's today Lebanon. It had been developed by Egyptians, and they were more experienced sailors, and they were the backbone of the Persian Imperial Navy in its western, that is, Aegean Mediterranean battlegrounds. And so it was they who formed the core of the Persian Imperial Navy when Persia tried to annex mainland Greece to its already huge empire, stretching all the way to Afghanistan and pretty much to Pakistan in the far southeast, and encompassing the whole of Asia through Iraq, through what's today Turkey and so on, up to the Aegean. You're quite right that it was absolutely crucial that especially the Athenians should develop a huge fleet of these triremes, which they did on the back of two things. One, they possessed this wonderful resource of silver in mines on Athens' own territory, which they used to coin money and therefore to be able to buy stuff. Secondly, they owned enough slaves to get the stuff, the metal, out of the ground. So it's that combination. Themistocles proposed to the assembly, let's devote, we've got this huge strike of silver, the funds to building a terrific fleet. The alternative proposition was, let's divide up this bounty so that everybody, the Athenians, get a little cash dividend, as it were. Well, to the Athenians' credit, they went with Themistocles. And the decisive battle on the sea was the Battle of Salamis in 480 BC. It wasn't actually the final battle, but nevertheless, had they lost that one, the whole thing would have been over. So you're completely right. And on the strength of that, the Athenian masses, the ordinary poor people who rowed the ships, quite rightly said, look, it's us on whom our Athens' military strength and therefore independence and therefore democracy depends. So we demand, and so it doesn't come immediately, it takes some years, eventually more and more power, control, rights, privileges go to the masses of the Athenian, the ordinary Athenian people, including, interestingly, political pay. So they introduce money. If you serve as a councillor, if you serve as a juryman, you get a little bit of pay, not a fortune, but it compensates you for time away from your fields or your workshop.
And the rich don't like that because, A, they don't need it, and B, it is fully allowing now poor people to participate.
Completely right. In fact, the word misthos, which is a word meaning pay, was a word of contempt because no wealthy person ever receives pay. They dole it out. So the notion that the Athenians, the poor Athenians, because they're Athenian citizens, could vote to give themselves a little bit of share of the public funds, that was regarded by the rich, by the elite, by the not very democratic, sometimes anti-democratic Athenian citizens, as a mark of almost servitude, a kind of slavery, wage slavery.
Paul Cartledge, can you talk to me about the role of demigods and demagoguery in ancient Athens and the ancient democratic system? Here we are again, once again today. People are, the word demagogue is back in vogue.
Yeah.
But it's a Greek word. I believe it even means leader of the people.
It does. And we're touching again on the same issue that different people see the same phenomenon from very different sides of the barricade. If you're a member of the assembly, you might be a member also of the council, so you might be reasonably well informed about a particular issue. But if you're not on the council, if you're an ordinary thing, there's no mass media, there's no Wikipedia, there's no way really of finding out the facts, let alone the way in which to evaluate the facts, except by listening to people whose advice you believe is worth listening to and taking. And that will be done on the basis of experience. So if somebody steps up and says, this is the case, this is my judgment of it, I advise you to vote this way, you vote that way, the Athenians do it, and it works, then that corroborates the notion that this leader of the people is a good leader of the people. What the negative sense of demagogue, our word demagogue, I think is wholly negative. Where that comes from is the notion that the sort of people who rise to power in a democracy are the smart guys who are glib at speaking. They appeal to the emotions, not the reason, and they persuade the masses who are not very well educated, not that smart, to believe and to do things which actually are not in the best interests of the community, or in particular in the best interests of the elite, the wealthy, the well-educated, and so on. And so the rises up, and this starts in terms of our evidence in plays of Aristophanes, a comic playwright, which you'd have thought would have appealed to the masses. Well, he made the masses laugh partly by depicting on stage fictional versions of recognizable political leaders who are represented precisely as misleaders of the people. Thucydides, contemporary of Aristophanes, he took the same view, but in a much more serious historical way. He genuinely thought that the reason Athens lost the great war that he was the historian of was because they'd been misled by clever speakers, great rhetoricians, who'd got it wrong. They'd got the wrong policies, they'd lied, and they had misled the people. So that demagogue meant for them misleader, rabble-rouser of the people.
That's interesting. Do you think that, whether we're talking about the ancient world or even today, demigods and demagoguery is something that's unique to democracies or is a part of democracies?
Well, it's no, I don't think it's unique to democracy. I think Erdogan and Putin and so on are as much demagogues in Turkey and Russia. The difference is the publicness, the immediacy of an ancient Athenian democratic assembly. It's government by mass meeting, so it's not done at a distance. It's not a parliament, which is a parliament of representatives who are chosen to speak and to act instead of the people. The people themselves act directly, and so demagogy has this transparency, this immediacy, which all our modern political systems just can't have. But one of my colleagues, an ancient historian, has tried to distinguish between demagogues, bad, and populists, well, not necessarily bad. In other words, they claim to know what's good for the people and to present to the people what they think the people want and should want, but really they're not necessarily getting it right, whereas demagogues, for this colleague of mine, always get it wrong because they're merely interested in their own promotion, self-promotion, power, glory, and so on. Well, we can all think probably of instances today in various parts of the world where you might want to call someone a populist, you might want to call them a demagogue, but in my opinion, they're both not very positive terms, because I personally would rather have more of a rational kind of debate and fact-based evaluation of politics rather than, what shall we call it, fake news, alternative facts, or barefaced lies, which seems to be quite becoming the norm in our democratic politics.
How was the democratic system in ancient Athens arranged? Were there different bodies? Did they at all serve checks on one another?
Yes, well, the principle of accountability was the most fundamental democratic notion of how, once you've elected someone to an office, or once someone has been chosen for an office by the use of the lottery, which is random, nevertheless, the people who hold that office use public money or make decisions, for example, as general, they've always got to think, what if it goes wrong? How am I going to avoid being brought to account, or how do I behave in such a way that I will not ever be brought to account? So the Athenian jury system, the legal system of control by popular mass, often hundreds of people, up, you know, for example, example, 501 tried Socrates. The laws of Athens are very broadly framed. They have to be interpreted, and they can be interpreted differently from occasion to occasion. So in other words, they didn't have the notion of precedent. But in all these ways, office holders, power holders are temporary, and they hold their power at the pleasure of responsible mass juries and other ways in which the people make sure that their officials, the people who are acting on their behalf, do so in a genuinely altruistic way.
My understanding, and please correct me if I'm wrong on this, but through much of the democratic life of ancient Athens, the upper class still had their hands on the lever of power through a body called the Areopagos.
Areopagos? Right. Well, now, yes and no, because the Areopagus was the old council, and it was only elite, aristocrats and so on. They were all elected. Well, one of the ways in which you mentioned earlier the Athenian democracy changed, developed, progressed, evolved, well, one of them was to strip the Areopagus of its old form of powers. Ultimately, it had been the body which, as it were, sat in judgment on the laws. So it was the guardian of the constitution. Well, once the constitution was democratic, it was completely inappropriate that an aristocratic body should have that function. However, in addition to stripping the body of its former powers, they also altered the composition of it, because the way in which the body was recruited was people who'd held a particular office called the archonship. There were 9 of them every year. After their year of office, they automatically became members of the Areopagus. Once upon a time, in the pre-democratic days, archons had all been elected, and elected from elite, from the top, wealthiest, most aristocratic families. Under the democracy, the mode of recruitment was altered from election to sortition to, in other words, the use of the lot, the random. Still, there were some economic qualifications, but there was no aristocratic qualification. So that the Areopagus becomes a more plebeian, shall we say, body, and it's much less centrally powerful. It exists, partly because the Athenians were very traditional, and it was a body instituted way back when Theseus, the alleged founder of Athens, way back when king of Athens. So therefore, they felt they couldn't abolish it altogether, but it was tamed, controlled.
What do you think, why do you think democracy comes to an end in Athens and eventually Greece? And I guess this is the rise of Macedonia and Alexander the Great, yeah, and his father, King Philip II. There are many reasons. You have the Peloponnesian War between Sparta and Athens. Issues of avarice, prolonged war. What do you think it is that? Because once we get rid of, once democracy no longer exists, we go a long time until we see it come around again.
You're quite right, and it's a combination of endogenous, exogenous, internal and external factors. The crucial external factor is that Athens became insufficiently weak to resist the major external power that wanted to conquer it. So whereas in the early 5th century, as we talked about, Athens had played a key role in the resistance to the Persian invasion, by the end of the, or towards the end of the 4th century BC, 150-odd years later, it was unable to resist the great power external to the southern Greek states, which was the power of Macedon, which had developed since the middle of the 4th century. So they lost a decisive battle, and that really was the beginning of the end of independence. And then secondly, since democracy was not to the taste of a foreign autocrat, a king, a monarch, which is what would have been the case, of course, had Persia won as well, eventually it was bound to be the case that democracy would be terminated at Athens, much to the delight of those internal critics of democracy whom we've talked about, i.e. the very wealthy, the very conservative, very right-wing, who thought that it was inherently wrong that the masses should be in a position to dictate to them, the masses being a kind of tyrant. So it's that combination of external and internal factors which terminated the Athenian democracy in the 320s. Versions of what they called democracy were tried again over the next years, decades, in fact centuries, until the next external power arose, and that of course was Rome, the Roman Empire. And though Rome called itself a people's state, so the Roman people were the rulers of the Romans and the Roman Empire, nevertheless they didn't have the Greek notion of one citizen, one vote, mass meetings with assemblies deciding policy and so on. They had a very powerful Senate, an oligarchical body based on wealth and so on. So they had no interest, the Romans, in perpetuating or tolerating democracy of the ancient Athenian kind. And then we're into, well, a very long period, the Middle Ages, we broadly call it, where you've got, for example, in Byzantium, in Constantinople, a theocracy now, Christian emperor, autocrat, claiming to rule in virtue of the mandate of heaven. So it's very difficult to argue against that, and that remains the case until the Renaissance, which rediscovers virtue in republican politics, Machiavelli to the fore here. Then, coincidentally, because it's not a direct result of Renaissance thinking, in Britain, the monarch irritated sufficiently numbers of non-monarchically minded Englishmen, such that we have civil wars, and the notion of the people comes to the fore again. Limited, of course, and by no means universal suffrage, not until the 20th century, but some notion of non-monarchical, non-autocratic, republican power becomes the norm, accelerated, of course, by the French and the American revolutions, which took great leaps forward.
Are there lessons for today? Democracy is ubiquitous. Even nations that have a hard time backing up their claim to being a democracy call themselves democracy.
Yeah.
Never have we had a time like this in world history, I imagine. Are there lessons for you in Athenian democracy, in ancient democracy, for our condition, our situation today?
Well, I put it this way rather differently, namely that we cannot recreate, though we, in theory, could use the internet and so on to practice direct democracy. Direct democracy requires a great deal of education and a great deal of commitment to a collective goal, which I don't think our individualistic societies are capable of reproducing. In China, in Russia, where there are still more collectivist ideals, it would theoretically be possible to introduce some democratic, in the ancient Greek sense of democratic, modes of political governance using electronic technology and so on. But oddly, it seems to go exactly the opposite way, that they have a tendency towards a tradition of autocracy, strong sole rule, and those societies show no signs of wanting to entrust ordinary people with a say on a daily basis. Well, what's the lesson I would draw from the last three centuries really is how tender, how rare a plant it is, democracy, in even our sense of indirect representative parliamentary democracy, a very tender plant. And I'm frightened by movements. I mean, we've had fascism outright, Nazism and fascism in the 20th century, but we seem to be moving back towards that kind of tendency again today in Europe. I'm not saying it's the case in your part of the world, and I'm very concerned about that. So all I'd say is education, education, education. Realize how difficult it's been to get where we are, the reasons why we've got where we are, and we must cling on to, make the most of, make the best of what we have, not abandon the gains of a very, very long period.
Yeah, all of us have lived in democratic systems for all of our lives now. And I guess we take it for granted. Did they take it for granted in Athens, ancient Athens?
Well, no, because we talked a bit about the tensions between rich and poor, and we talked about the tensions between the different cities. They lived on the edge much more than we did. We've been in the West, I'm talking about, since the Second World War, a period of extraordinary stability and peace. Not universal, but quite extraordinary for those of us who benefited from living where we have done. The ancients would not have been able to take that for granted. They had rather to fear what they called stasis, which means literally a standing apart, division, that could spill over into civil war. And Herodotus said that civil war, that's absolutely the worst possible thing that can happen. Because what it means at the limit is brother kills brother and so on. Greece in the 1940s, Spain in the 1930s, civil war is peculiarly unpleasant. And that was much more a genuine threat in ancient Greece than it is in most countries today in the West.
Paul Cartledge has joined us for a conversation on ancient Athenian democracy. Paul Cartledge is the A.G. Leventis Senior Research Fellow of Clare College and A.G. Leventis Professor of Greek Culture Emeritus at the University of Cambridge. He's the author of a number of books. The one we've been talking about is called Democracy, A Life. Paul Cartledge, I've enjoyed our conversation very much, and I thank you greatly.
Thank you, Mitch. It's been an honor and a pleasure to talk with you and your audience.